From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
We're actually taking people that are criminals, very, very hardened criminals in some cases, with a tremendous track record of abuse and problems, and we're getting them out.
The last thing Canadians expect is for me to come down and lecture another country on how they choose to govern themselves.
The president's national security advisor, Michael Flynn, resigned last night over conversations he had with Russia before Mr. Trump took office.
The Washington Post reports on questions about a Facebook photo taken at Mar-a-Lago this weekend as the president met with Japan's prime minister.
Kremlin is also rejecting reports Russian intelligence contacted members of Trump's election team.
Perhaps that the Russians helped him in the election, and this is sort of a quid pro quo.
Those are some of the stories that we'll talk about today in The Wheelhouse. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Sitting in today for the vacationing Colin McEnroe is Dan Haar. Dan Haar, of course, writes for the Hartford Current on a number of issues. And Danny, it's good to see you once again.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Also with us is our friend Bill Curry, Democratic political analyst. Bill, nice to have you here once again.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And here for the first time with us is Liz Karantowicz, who's a political consultant, former chief of staff and finance director for the Connecticut Republican Party. Liz, great to see you here. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for so much for having me, guys.
So we're going to start national, and we're going to get to an awful lot of things happening at the state capitol, including a piece that Danny wrote this week about whether or not Dan Malloy is indeed a lame duck right now. He's certainly not acting like it. But maybe we need to start with the big news of the day. The New York Times reporting this morning that Donald Trump's aides during the campaign spoke with Russian intelligence officials, some of which we already knew. We've learned an awful lot more in the investigation into Michael Flynn, who resigned as national security advisor just the other day. Among the people, Dan Haar, that are wrapped up in this, not surprisingly, once again, Connecticut's own Paul Manafort makes another surprise appearance in the New York Times.
Actually, no, he was the original Russian connection. Actually, he wasn't the original Russian connection. Bill is shaking his head. We're going to get to that. But he, of course, has legitimate business ties to Russia. And one of the things he said during the past week or so was, I'm paraphrasing here, it's something along the lines of, you know, people don't wear a badge that says that they're KGB or Russian intelligence, right? You're doing business and you're talking with somebody legitimately about your business. And so if later it comes out that you have had, quote, contact with Russian intelligence officials, hey, you're doing business. And that's from his side. But he's less culpable because he, at least in the recent past, had some business ties there versus members of
Freudian slip.
Yes. Members of the Trump campaign. And even worse, according to the New York Times, people associated with Trump who were not in the campaign.
Bill?
That bit about they don't wear badges is defendant speak for, yes, I did. I would just say that first of all, this is if anyone who collaborated, if anyone did, with any Russian agents, committed multiple felonies. Every single conversation which enabled a foreign conspiracy was a violation of, among other things, campaign finance laws. If you want to know whether it amounts to treason, read the Alexander Hamilton's Federalist paper on the Electoral College, which goes into great detail about what it means for a foreign power to try to subvert the democratic process and what a high crime and misdemeanor.
I'm hearing
that is,
a lot, by the way,
treason.
About Alexander Hamilton these days. He's doing some great work,
he
from
is
what
doing,
I understand.
Yeah,
he
well,
really is.
Who knew he was a composer?
But anyway, please continue.
I just look at this and think, you know, it took Nixon 5 years to get to the what did the president know and when did he know it question. And Trump did it in 3 weeks. Congratulations,
Donald. Here's what I will say. Very important in this New York Times report today as they talk about these campaign officials talking with very senior Russian officials, Bill, they are saying there's no collusion that they can find whatsoever.
Yeah.
Conversations happened,
they didn't say it quite,
but there's the
way.
Absence of collusion.
Yeah, they didn't. All they said was they hadn't found it yet. And
well,
I would just
that
say this
is the absence
but,
of.
But this is the question.
Yeah.
But the question on the table now is not whether everybody should go out and vote to impeach the guy. But the questions are treason and impeachment. And it's been so hard for us to discuss the things about Trump that are wrong because we for good reason, journalists don't come easily to questions of mental health, character, fraud, you know, all the extremism that's involved here. But those things would be. And so the question on the table now is whether we're even going to take sworn testimony, whether we're even going to have a public hearing to find out. The House Republicans are already on record. They're not doing it. Rand Paul's on record. I don't want to do it. The Senate's not on record for even acting on this. And so what I'm arguing for is the seriousness of the underlying crime that is possible here. And there's more evidence for this crime than there is for your average U.S. attorney's or FBI investigation.
Yeah, I do think it's clear
that there are
Senate committee hearings at least going into this, Liz.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I guess my question to you would be, what further evidence of Republican investigations? You know, I mean, I'm hearing a lot from Republicans saying that they're wanting to look into this, that they're opening investigations, that they've got purview to bring folks in and have them answer some tough questions. I was listening to Paul Ryan on my way in this morning, who expressed a lot of concern about not just the Trump administration, but the same concerns that he had with the Bush administration and the Obama administration about this notion that in some way, shape, or form, cozying up to the Russians was going to, you know, sort of get them to put their oars in the water and row in the same direction as the United States. And he himself believes that's, you know, sort of not the right approach. But I guess my question for you is, you know, I'm hearing a lot of Republicans who are Trumpers are upset with Republicans in Congress who have expressed a lot of serious concern about what's going on with the Russian connections and wanting to open investigations. So I guess my question for you is how much more do they need to do?
Let me just say two things. First of all, you haven't heard a single Republican in charge of a single committee even commit to taking sworn testimony. When specifically asked, they've demurred. You haven't heard a single commitment to a public hearing. You haven't heard a single commitment to even interview Flynn, the primary witness. Not one. And so everybody wants to get on in front of the TV cameras right now and say, don't worry, we're going to really look into this. But so far, the only firm commitment has been to investigate the whistleblowers who exposed this.
Well, and I do want to ask about that, because this is what Donald Trump has been tweeting about this morning, Dan. This is what we're hearing from others in the administration, that the real problem here is with these leaks. And let's just be clear, leaks about national intelligence are actually probably something that any administration should probably be able to get their hands around a little bit more easily than they have.
Well, we're a big country, and we have plenty of room for plenty of real problems. And if the leaks are a real problem, so is the potential contact with Russian intelligence. I would disagree with Bill. I think we have to tease out what is wrongdoing and what is highly unusual behavior in the political arena from what is normal political posturing. And it's early yet. We're in the first few days of this latest version. I know we're not in the first few. I'm going to talk in a minute about the revelations that came out in October that nobody paid attention to, because it came out exactly in the weekend of the Comey memo. But we're early yet in this latest iteration of this, and it has to play out for a couple of days. It's not highly, highly unusual for Chaffetz, for example, to be saying the situation is playing itself out. What he means by that is, like, get hold of yourselves, guys. We're going to have a few minutes, and if we need to call hearings, we'll call hearings. I'm okay with that. I'm not okay with what I think happened, but I don't think that it's that Democrats are yet right in saying this is an outrage, lack of activity.
So I'll just ask Liz, as someone, and you've already said this to Bill, that some Republicans have come out and said, we do want to seriously look into this. But as a Republican, I mean, what do you want to hear from leadership, both in the House and the Senate, on the Republican side, people who are actually going to say, this is a very serious matter, we are going to investigate fully, because we seem to have had Russian meddling in a U.S. election, and we also seem to have continued revelations of contacts between Russians and the Trump administration and the Trump campaign before that. What would you like to see Republicans do more than they have?
Well, I think, you know, I agree with Dan here. I think it's early yet, and so we've got to – they're gathering information. They're figuring out what the right steps are to take. I don't think anybody would want them to go, to go off prematurely and get themselves or anybody else into a situation they can't get out of. But I think all Republicans want this dispelled of as quickly as possible so they can get on to talking about a policy agenda. I mean, you know, and not just from a political perspective. I'm talking about from a policy perspective. You know, Paul Ryan is a speaker who wants to get things done. He sees this as an opportunity to really act on some significant policy changes for the country, not the least of which is repealing and replacing Obamacare and passing significant tax reform. And they're going to get bogged down in having to talk about all of this until they can, you know, sort of get this out of the public domain.
But you've said this all during this campaign, Bill. I mean, the election was about this economic inequality. It was about so many people in America feeling as though they were left out. Part of the thing that Donald Trump capitalized on was this feeling. And Paul Ryan says he wants to, you know, use this opportunity to fix problems with economic equality. He wants to actually go in and change the way the tax system works. None of those things are the things that the Trump administration has spent any time on whatsoever over the course of the last few weeks. They've spent time on a travel ban that has, I think, by all counts, not worked out very well for them and has ended up in the courts. And secondly, they've had to deflect time after time after time allegations and now new information about their closeness to Russia. I mean, does a Paul Ryan ever get a chance to get close to whatever plan he has for America if this is all it's about?
There are so many ways to approach this. You can look at this as a casebook study and the reason why you don't make someone president who has no experience whatsoever in government. And that'll go on for months, and that's the kind of back and forth that you'd expect from the parties, and it's the kind of jostling and so on. But let me just – I need to go back to this. Mm. I really do believe that if you just clear away the smoke for a second here and look at what the seriousness of what is alleged – and ask yourself, again, the question here, all I heard for the last 48 hours was every single person in charge in the Congress refusing to commit to issuing subpoenas. And if there's one lesson from Watergate, from the Nixon and Clinton impeachments, the one thing we learned, you know, the only people who went to jail for the Watergate burglary were the five burglars. Everybody else who went to jail in Watergate went to jail for something someone said once they rose their right hand, raised their right hand.
And I completely agree with you, but I'm just going to.
And so if we could get a commitment, if we could get an understanding now that these are indeed the stakes, that changes how we approach this. And there's so much evidence. You had a campaign chairman who was a paid political operative of the Putin faction in Ukraine. You had a presidential candidate calling on the Russians to do this. You've had this extraordinary, these extraordinary leaks now.
But the only thing
the
I'll say, Bill,
community.
Is it's just to back up something that Liz said.
There couldn't be more evidence.
The only thing that I'll back up from what Liz said is that we are very, very new into this. As Dan pointed out, look, I don't know that necessarily every Republican being on the record right now, a couple days after these allegations come forward about Michael Flynn or about what's happening in the New York Times today, that some action has to happen right now. Will that necessarily be the best possible thing that could happen?
Hold on one second. Because here's the thing. You know, I mean, everyone smells, you know, sees the blood in the water. My kid's a big shark aficionado, so I'm familiar with this, right? When the blood is in the water, everybody comes. What more do you, if they come out and if they come out and say what you want them to say, then what's the next step? I mean, my feeling is that, you know, this is just going to continue, and Democrats are going to do what they're going to do because it becomes a partisan issue, and they're going to continue.
I agree with you on that.
I'm talking about the posturing of it in terms of it when Republicans get to a place where they're saying what you're saying and they're saying we're going to take sworn testimony and we're going to have hearings. Then what? Then what next step are you going to demand of them?
When we look back at Watergate, everybody remembers the names Woodward and Bernstein. But the fact of the matter is that if there weren't a John Sirica and a Sam Dash and an Irvin, the government, that story would have stopped.
Lowell Weicker.
And Lowell Weicker, yes, sir. And that would have stopped in its tracks. We never would have known. Because as I learned when I was trying to out John Rowland on defrauding the taxpayers of Connecticut of hundreds of millions of dollars in shady deals for his donors, if you don't have subpoena power, you can't nail the case. And so the question every time you come to this is, and the question that's on the table right now is, are you going to take sworn testimony?
Are you going to have public hearings? And so far, the answer from every single responsible Republican in Congress is no.
So but in the last 48 hours,
this is why I want to put this to Dan Haar. You are saying, obviously, this is a very serious matter of national security, and this isn't just partisan politics. Do you believe that the politics being put on hold slightly might result in a better outcome of all this? For instance, if Democrats don't jump right in to Democrats and Republicans don't jump right into saying when they're going to have committee investigations, that we might end up with a better result because this is, as you say, a very, very serious case and a very serious charge.
I think that's a fair point. The Watergate hearings, the Watergate hearings were the summer of 1973 and the Watergate burglary was June 16th, 1972. By the way, I just want to let it be said that I did hear Bill Curry blame me just now for not listening to him in September of 2002. And that is what just happened, and that's okay. He may be right.
You weren't even at that press conference.
But seriously, all kidding aside about this, yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I'm not saying that there's any danger to starting early. There are just a lot of issues here. And I do want to quickly mention that on October, I think it was 30th or 31st, which was the weekend after or the Sunday or Monday after the Comey memo that sort of roiled the nation, rightly, Franklin Foer on Slate had an article documenting a group of public and private investigators had uncovered the existence of a server in the Trump Tower going back to 2011 that was directly linked to some murky bank in Russia that they still think has some Russian intelligence. This is going back four years before he declared his candidacy. So there are links here that may be legitimate. There are links that don't look legitimate. And there's a whole lot more than just what happened in the election.
We're going to have to move on quickly. And before we take a break, I want to actually talk about someone we heard at the very top of the program. Chris Murphy has been making quite a name for himself in the Senate, and not just in the last couple of weeks, but he was on Morning Joe once again talking about Trump's ties to Russia. And now it seems, Liz, that he is emerging as one of the top potential Democratic challengers to Donald Trump in 2020. Even reading in the New York Post that Steve Bannon has asked consultants to scour the backgrounds of four outspoken Democrats. Senator Chris Murphy's right at the top of the list.
So who did Chris Murphy plant that story with? I bet it's done wonders for his fundraising.
I can only imagine that.
I think Chris Murphy's always shown himself to be an ambitious politician, so it wouldn't surprise me in the least if he's got his designs on the White House. I think the Democrat Party, much like the Republican Party was 8 years ago, is struggling to find its sea legs here, and not just at the national level. I think you look across the country, and they've lost a lot of legislative seats. They've lost a lot of governorships, and so they've got to kind of find their way. I don't know that the results of this election bear out that you move to the left. I saw a poll this morning. I think it was from Politico. Donald Trump beats Elizabeth Warren by 43-35 or something like that right now. I think they've got to find their way. They've got to figure it out. But, you know, Chris Murphy has shown himself to be an able and aggressive politician. So it wouldn't surprise me in the least he'd put himself on a list to ascend to the presidency.
Now, Bill, you have been saying for quite some time that a move to the left is exactly what the party should be doing.
It just depends upon what you mean. What I've been saying for even longer is that all the old categories are defunct, mm-hmm. and that there's a new political debate which is struggling to be born here. And I used to say in the campaign trail that what people wanted were Democratic ends by Republican means. They wanted decent schools and a clean environment and fair workplaces, and they wanted a fiscal responsibility, which used to be Republican trait, and they wanted high ethics. And I think that someone's going to come along and find this hidden consensus within American politics, and do very well. But the part of it that Elizabeth Warren has identified with, the willingness to stand up to powerful moneyed interests and to regulate them. Again, there's a simple distinction here for Democrats to make, and that is small business actually does need less regulation, and big business needs more. And they need to change this from an abstract to a specific debate. I'm not sure Elizabeth Warren's the best standard bearer. I've had some reservations about her candidacy throughout this. And as far as Chris Murphy's concerned, let's drum out all the ambitious politics from the presidential politicians from the presidential race. There won't be many people left. The secret for him or her, I believe,
is to find not just more ways to criticize Donald Trump, even though we must do that right now in the midst of this crisis, but to get on to your own agenda as quickly as possible. And if the Democrats had spent the last 4 weeks debating Trump's executive orders rather than his missteps, they'd be killing him right now.
Dan, last thought on Chris Murphy, maybe someone who jumps into this race very early?
Well, for the record, he's saying he's not running, and I guess that means he may be running or he may not be running.
Dan's so naive.
He's very, yeah.
Right,
he's,
yeah.
I love
there,
it.
There,
just,
there are a lot
yeah.
of angles you can look at this. They,
but he
you,
says
you,
no.
You can say that the Republicans are building up Chris Murphy because they may think he's more beatable. Than somebody else. You just don't know. There's too much intrigue going on. He's a good guy. He's clean. The dossier probably has very little in it. We can agree on that.
And if that leak was to the New York Post, it didn't come from a Democrat.
Yeah, well, I must be thinking of all those Huffington Post stories.
I'm sure there are a million of them, but not that one.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about someone who is not really acting like a lame duck. That's Governor Dan Malloy. We're talking today with Dan Harr from the Hartford Courant, Bill Currier, Democratic political analyst, and Republican political analyst Liz Grandowitz. Here in the Wheelhouse, I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Dan Harr from the Hartford Courant, Bill Currier, Democratic political analyst, and political consultant Liz Karantowicz. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is away this week enjoying the sunshine, but you can hear his program live from Watkinson School about the music of Brian Wilson, something that I know Bill Curry is very excited about listening to this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. We've been talking about national politics, but let's talk a little bit more local right now and talk about the state budget that Dan Malloy put out not so very long ago. Dan, as you look at all, before we get to some of what you wrote in a piece about Dan Malloy and whether or not his actions suggest that he is someone who is in the lame duck stretch of a governorship. Let's talk more about some of the specifics that are in this budget. What do you see in the budget that Dan Malloy put out that we should be paying most close attention to? His relationship with towns, his funding for schools. What is it you see in here?
The 138 towns that lose money is a political non-starter. You can't go into a legislature represented, I might add, overrepresented by small towns versus big cities, and expect to have 138 out of the 169 of them lose money, including towns such as South Windsor, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wallingford, Groton, and what's the other big one? Milford, losing huge amounts. Millions approaching 10, each. And I think that the governor seems to know that that's where the political power lies. He's maybe making a statement, or he's maybe trying to get something in that's lesser. But that's a big deal. And part of the point was what I was saying in the column was that that's essentially a reform that doesn't change the budget picture one way or another, up or down. And that's what's so amazing about this, is that here is a guy in the third term or second half of his second term.
Another
like
Freudian
third
slip.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Second
like
half of the second
Let's
term.
Fourth.
Doing what look like major government reforms that he doesn't need to do in order to patch up a budget. And so I think that's the thing you have to really look at the biggest. Of course, the union stuff is huge as well.
Well, and actually, the state's largest teachers union, the Connecticut Education Association, has taken to the airwaves to blast Governor Malloy's plans to redirect about $2.1 billion in education aid to the state's most impoverished communities, away from those communities Dan was just talking about. Let's listen a little bit to this commercial.
What does it take to secure the future of Connecticut? It takes investment in our public schools and a state budget that works for all of us, especially our children. But that's being threatened by a plan that would divide our local public schools into winners and losers. Tell your legislators that we're
okay. So winners and losers, Liz, and as Dan says, this is one of the really important things. So Governor Malloy taking on all these towns where a lot of the political power of the state lies, and then also taking on a teachers union that isn't so happy about the cuts either.
Sure. Well, I go back to something that you kind of alluded to. I mean, 138 towns. You sort of scratch your head and go, you know, are we to take this budget really seriously? I mean, is this really just sort of, you know, punting to the legislature to say, okay, well, this is my best shot. Now go for it. I think, look, you know, the governor, he's got to build a willing coalition. He's now got an 18-18 even split in the Senate. You know, he's lost over the course of his tenure, I believe, somewhere north of, you know, 41 legislative seats. A balance of power is certainly not gone in his favor. 77% of Connecticut residents don't believe that he's done a good job handling the budget. And so, you know, you kind of have to sit there and go, what are we to take this budget seriously? I think the budget situation is certainly serious, and we've got to figure out a way forward. But
whether or not the gesture is him taking the budget problem seriously, what do you think of this particular gesture? I mean, as he looks at everything from a court ruling about funding to schools to the landscape of where money from the state really needs to go, is the governor from where you sit, Liz, actually making some sort of an effort to rebalance things, making some sort of an effort to not spend money where it's not necessarily needed?
I think it's really a tough situation. I mean, I think there's a huge lack of trust. I think over the last, you know, 6 years, we've been sold a bill of goods over and over and over again, concessions from the union. And this isn't just taxpayers. I mean, I think the unions have gotten, you know, kind of put into a tough place. I mean, it's when you're looking at, you know, the state employee unions and Republicans and mayors and everybody's against the budget. And I think the governor's sitting back and going, well, you know, these decisions hurt everybody. And it's sort of like a parent, you know, you can't, you're almost succeeding when everybody's unhappy, you know. But, you know, that's not the way forward here. I don't think that's going
to
work.
So some Democrats have reached out to me, Bill, over the course of the last couple of weeks and said, look, you may not like Dan Malloy and his approval numbers may be really, really low, but he is kind of like the dentist who's fixing the problem of, you know, the legislature and prior governors eating a whole lot of candy over the course of several decades. And this is what it looks like when the dentist goes to work.
Yeah, although it's especially what it looks like if you go to the dentist with a cavity and he gives you an appointment to come back in 6 years. Okay, and so that, you know, all those previous governors contributed to this problem. But the first Malloy budget, it was sort of the original sin of his administration, and he'll live with it till he leaves office. And everybody, unions, taxpayers, legislators, everybody had to be a part of a solution then, and no one was. And where I differ with Danny, well, almost everything, but let's just take this morning. Where I differ with Danny is simply this.
Grudges do last a long time, don't they?
Not at all. Not in this case.
So please, where are you differing with Danny?
And that is that I don't see these as really big things. I see, if I were more of a conspiracy theorist, I'd almost say that putting up a budget that you know that 138 towns are going to suffer from, that's not going to get adopted, is a way of walking away, not walking into a problem.
I think that's kind of what I'm saying.
And if I've inadvertently
But he didn't want to say Liz, that he agreed with you.
If I inadvertently agreed with Liz, who's doing a lovely job this morning, by the way.
Thank you, Mr.
Then,
Curry.
Then, you know, forgive me. But I think that's there. And when you talk about structural reforms, there are many structural reforms. The biggest structural reform is property tax reform. And now we'd have to phase it in because we blew this so badly. We could have done it, but now it's something we have to get to incrementally. But we ought to put the law on the books. Dealing with health care reform. The biggest savings in the budget is in health care. Malloy hasn't touched it in 6 years. He didn't touch the pensions when he had to. We haven't done, again, Dan and I disagree.
That's not true. He definitely did a health care reform in 2011. There's no question about it. First of all, the second tier and the third tier.
No, you're talking about health care reform for state employees, which has had almost none of the success that was predicted for it. In terms of effectiveness. But I'm talking about structural change in the healthcare market. He ran on a plan to institute a public option and to drive down healthcare costs for small businesses.
We've got the best functioning Obamacare exchange in the country.
Which isn't saying much.
And the Obamacare program doesn't work very well, Dan.
This is like what the Romans don't feel. Oh, well, there's the Romans. There's that.
We're getting off topic here about the budget.
Let me just say this.
Yeah.
Let me just say this. The healthcare is as big a part of our budget as it was. Our only salvation is driving the cost down. You can't do it without market reform. He ran on market reform. And then a week after he got elected,
made an appearance with the heads of the insurance industry and said, we're not doing it.
So let's bring
that's
it back
where the money is, and that's where structural reform is.
And Bill's saying, you know, the hole in the budget, Liz, has to do with these things and has to do with reforms that we haven't made yet. So help us fix the budget. What do we need to be paying attention to that we're maybe not in this budget cycle?
Look, I'm not a budget expert, and I certainly haven't been around or in the process to the extent certainly that you have. But, you know, I think the thing that's frustrating is Republicans have offered alternative budgets. They've offered a way forward every single time. And everyone sits across the table and says, no, you come to the table with something. They have offered solutions. And I see just shy of an eye roll there. But
I don't want to argue with Liz anymore. Dan? Yeah.
One of us is shaking our head and the other one is rolling his eyes. So which one gets to talk?
Yeah. Okay, you get to talk, Dan. You haven't talked in a while.
The Republican budget that was proposed last year, for example, relied on $300 million in employee savings without laying anyone off. Malloy at least said if we're going to have $300 million in savings, we're going to lay people off. And as a matter of fact, I think through management, they've kept the number of layoffs relatively below what we below what we thought. So there are no easy answers.
There are no easy answers.
I do think that there needs to be a half point increase in the sales tax, which raises $300 million. Also a broadening of the sales tax, which could easily raise, if you broaden just 10% of the exemptions, you could raise another $200 or $300 million. Right, and I don't like tax increases. Nobody does, even Democrats. But the reality is that there's other alternatives here. The $700 million from the unions is a tough nut to get, and it can be had. There are ways to make that number add up, but you have to exchange with the unions an extension of the CBAC agreement that gives them the pension benefits that are so expensive way beyond 2022. That may not be worth the trade-off.
Look, the we were sold on shared sacrifice, right? That was the talking point, the banner for the 2011 budget that really hit small businesses, you know, middle income families, working families in Connecticut very hard. And then you continue to go forward. The economy's not growing, it's shrinking. We're losing jobs. People are leaving in droves. And you can't just, you know, the talking points of shared sacrifice, punting it to the municipalities to say, we know you're going to end up having to enact a property tax that's going to make it harder for, you know, the businesses in your town, for the families that are in your town. You know, this is, we've got to start really tackling this issue, and we can't do it with platitudes.
I want to say this very slowly and clearly. Mm. Liz is right.
Wow. I hope my uncle is listening.
Take a minute to resume normal breathing here. It's what Chris Christie did in New Jersey. He made all these cuts, including tax cuts and then spending cuts, and all the spending cuts were dumped on the cities and towns. And then he went around the country saying he'd cut taxes for the average New Jersey resident. But the average New Jersey resident's taxes had gone up because what municipalities provide are services people are much more attached to, police, fire, schools. And so I think this does walk down that road, frankly. And I'm skeptical of it, highly. But it's also true to what every one of us has said at some point is, we're now in a tough situation, and I'm just going to relate this to a larger question. That is that one of the things that Democrats have to do, if I'm right in what I said before about ethics and fiscal integrity, is that they have to find ways to embrace not just spending but reform. And reform, as Governor Malloy said when he was running, reform has to come first. And there are lots of things you can do here that don't cost money. That aren't about writing a check, but are about changing the rules. And Dan loved the accountability boards for the cities. All it said to me was the dozen towns, and we know which ones they are, that are going to get into deep trouble because of this. We'll all have the state come in and take over their budgets. I'm not that crazy about that.
Well, the state's not doing a great job with its own budget.
better than some of those towns. But the point is, but I agree in grassroots democracy, the closest you can get. What they could all use is an independent ethics commission, which my own party, as well as the Republicans, have opposed for a long time. If they want to give, well, the bill's been in the hopper for years; it never gets passed. And if they want to give people more faith that the money they're spending is being well spent, they could start there.
I just want to go quickly to Dan's column this week. Dan Malloy, no lame duck. Here's a little bit from the Current's website. Here's William Tong from Stanford, a representative, and Lori Pelletier, president of the Connecticut AFL-CIO, talking a bit about this governor and his budget.
What we saw today is the governor is every bit as hard-charging as he's ever been. He's ready to face the challenges that we have as a state. He's got one speed, he doesn't slow down, he doesn't change, and he's got one volume, and it's 11.
So this governor in this budget is different than the governor we've seen just 2 years ago. And whatever he's repositioning for, it's not helping the state of Connecticut.
Okay, so the politics of this actually are kind of important, Dan, because if we've got a governor who is not running as a lame duck or governing as a lame duck and perhaps even running for another term, this is a very different thing politically than if we have the governor kind of stepping away from this massive problem that he and prior governors haven't really been able to fix.
I had one comment on our website that said, "You're absolutely wrong. He's a lame duck, and you'll see how badly he loses in that next election." So I said, okay.
That's not how it works.
I didn't respond to that one. Yeah. But, I mean, William Tong represents an important potential group in the legislature. He's not – if Malloy can patch together a large enough collection of Democrats and give enough and not raise taxes so that he gets some Republican votes, which is going to be a tough
That's
nut.
That's not happening.
Well, see, there you go. That's exactly the problem right there. It's not happening. Going in, he's not getting any Republican votes. Last year, he had a Republican budget that the Republicans voted 100% against because they didn't get one thing they
wanted. I thought you were talking about Republican voters, not Republican legislators.
Okay.
All right. just to clarify. All right.
But in any case, William Tong represents not labor and not towns. But, hey, let's make the state work. And if that can be patched together by Malloy, that can happen. I quickly want to add that this is the only governor who's lowered the number of people working for the state. The state workforce in the executive branch is down 9% since he took office. That is a reform.
Look, and Liz, you were talking about, this governor, Democrats who've been in charge of the legislature, punting this football down the field. And I think a lot of people understand that's what's happening. A couple times, the Republicans put up a challenger, and Tom Foley said, basically, the economy's going to fix itself. I've got these great projections moving forward, and we don't really have to raise any taxes. We don't really have to make deep cuts to government because it's all going to fix itself. Clearly, the Republican Party hasn't really figured this out either. What does the Republican Party need to do as you position to try to get the governorship during this next election to actually have something better than the Tom Foley plan of, really the economy's on an upswing, we'll be fine, no new taxes?
Well, look, I think I agree with you. I don't think it's fair to ever call Dan Malloy a lame duck. I mean, this guy has one speed, right? And it's go, 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 go. And I'm certain he's probably far away from making a decision about what he's going to do. Look, the midterms are coming up. Who knows what that's going to look like? I think to prejudge those situations right now is really not smart. I mean, conventional wisdom was wrong about what Trump was going to do in November, and that's going to maintain. I think on the Republican side, our answers need to be one where, this governor in particular has believed that a top-down approach to growing the economy is right. And I think most Republicans I know believe that a bottom-up approach is the right way. I think most people, would agree. Dan Malloy looks at things and says, government here is going to pick winners and losers in this economy. And I think that's been true. And I think this budget is reflective of that. You've got the first five or fast five program and that's success is certainly in question. But a lot of times that pitted municipalities against each other. We're going to move Bridgewater Hedge Fund from Westport to Stamford, and we're going to give the largest hedge fund in the world, tons of money to do that. And now this budget does that, in pitting towns and cities against each other. So I think Republican answer to the governor, again, look at leader Claritas. Look at Len Fasano and what their caucuses are doing. And their caucuses have grown considerably since Dan Malloy took office.
I'll just quickly say, and I think on this program we've been as critical of the top-down picking winners projects as any place else in terms of giving out big money to hedge funds. That said, if Republicans believe that people are leaving in droves, the companies are leaving in droves, I can't imagine that a Republican governor sitting in exactly the same seat wouldn't be doing exactly the same things, trying to strike individual deals with individual companies to try to make sure they stay right here in Connecticut and not flee off to Boston or someplace else.
Sure. And look, I'm not going to speak on behalf of any candidates. I'm speaking as a Republican looking at the situation. GE didn't leave because they weren't offered enough of a package. I think they left because what happens is they're looking at the situation. They're going to go, okay, well, UTC got this, and this company got this, and this company got that, and you're making your budget is not sustainable. So that means you're going to come back to us and ask for higher taxes and more revenue down the line.
Danny says it's wrong. We're going to get to Danny and then quickly before we go.
You're wrong on both counts. First of all, it had nothing to do with them leaving because other companies were getting things. In fact, they got one of the biggest packages in American history from Boston and Massachusetts. Second of all, they left because they wanted to be in a big city where lots of people who graduate from universities want to live and go. Connecticut lacks that. That's the problem. The problem has nothing to do with budget management in respect to GE. They proved that by going to one of the most expensive places on the planet. It's not about cost.
Bill, last word before we got to take a break.
And just you guys are both right. It ought to be in different ways. It ought to be bottom up, not top down. And these guys pack up their tents and leave overnight, the big guys, and they'd leave for structural reasons. When GE, a company that doesn't pay any taxes, says it's leaving because of taxes, you got to take a second look at that. When Pfizer, to whom we gave every single thing they asked, and leaving the city of New London in a permanent civil war, leaves anyway, you have to wonder. People say that 70% of all new jobs come from small businesses. It's true. But not 70% of all jobs are in small businesses, because jobs in small businesses die faster. Some of that's risk. But part of it's the fact that we've created an economy which constantly militates against their interest. If Connecticut wants to grow, it has to get off the big corporate bribery program. And it has to figure out how to bring costs down and improve services for the kinds of businesses that, when they prosper, don't leave.
I don't disagree with that at all. And yep. I agree with you. It's structural. It's not just about cost, but you can't ignore the concern about the volatility of the budget and how deep those pockets are that are going to be picked. I don't disagree with you.
And they did indeed say that along the way. They wanted to be in a town like Boston. They also were really, really scared about this looming budget deficit and the sorts of decisions the state was going to have to make.
We didn't make it any easier on them.
Liz Karantowicz is here along with Bill Curry and Dan Haar from the Hartford Current. When we come back, we're going to tackle a few more stories we didn't get to, including the Yukon women hitting a real big milestone, and are people paying attention to that? It's coming up next in the Wheelhouse.
I am, John.
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, and we're talking with Democratic analyst Bill Curry and our Republican analyst today, Liz Karantowicz, a former finance director and chief of staff for the Connecticut Republican Party. And we got to tackle a few things in just rapid succession. Very quickly, Bill, I want to talk about some of the fallout over the course of the last couple of weeks. The Trump administration, as I said earlier, seems to only have really accomplished these two things, this ongoing scandal around ties to Russia, and then also this botched travel ban, which is tied up with the question of sanctuary cities. New Haven, Hartford are two of them. We just saw this last week, a roundup of hundreds of undocumented immigrants, not here in Connecticut, but in other places, including New York City. I guess I'm wondering if you see a battle brewing between some of these sanctuary cities and the Trump administration, which says they're going to cut off all funding, which could lead to a bit of hardship for towns like Hartford that already have big holes in the budget.
Dave Chappelle was on Saturday Night Live the weekend after the election, did a great job, and he said about the Black Lives Matter movement, it might not be the best slogan, but "you deserve a break today" was already taken. And sanctuary cities is itself a phrase. It's a moral phrase, and it's an inspiring phrase in many ways. But it actually confuses the underlying issue, which is whether or not local law enforcement officials can be impressed by the federal government to enforce laws that are not their responsibility. And I remember when Republicans like Bob Dole used to carry the 10th Amendment around their pocket and whip it out every time there was a discussion about letting cities and towns and states do what they wanted to.
and that seems to have gone by the boards. And so I do think there's a conflict brewing here, not because the steps that Trump is contemplating will do anything about the immigration problems that beset the country, but only because he thinks it's good message with his base. And Democrats, again, on all these issues, have to go back to what they may or may not have learned in high school debate societies, where you encounter every point with concreteness and specificity. This is about whether Donald Trump can tell every town what they're to enforce and what they aren't to enforce. And the answer to that is really simple. He can't.
I just have to ask you, Liz, quickly, because we're running low on time. This question that Bill brings up, though, about it's another conflict between Donald Trump playing to a base and doing things he said he was going to do on the campaign trail, maybe rubbing up against things that might be really good policy for the Republican Party moving forward. And is taking on sanctuary cities in this way really good national political policy?
You know, I think that has yet to be determined. As I said before, you know, I mean, I think all conventional wisdom on the politicking of this, you know, kind of has to go by the wayside simply because we're in a very unconventional time. You know, I think the fact is that Republicans are going to have to do the things that they need to do to enact good policies in this country. And I think Paul Ryan, as Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell as leader in the Senate, they have a path forward, and they're going to stick to their policies and try to the best of their ability to not get
But their path forward down. Isn't starting. That's right. And their path forward wouldn't be starting with sanctuary cities, wouldn't be starting with
not.
A big deportation.
No, and I think that's obvious just based on the leadership of the House since the 2010 election. And I think that's been true of the Republican Senate and majority. These guys want to tackle issues that impact every single American family, which are health care and tax reform.
Danny, a last thought on this, on sanctuary cities and maybe a brewing battle with the Trump administration?
Yeah, if the Trump administration does what it says, which is only go after felons, there are few, if any, cities, whether or not they use the word sanctuary, that as a matter of policy protect convicted felons. So there shouldn't be a clash. The question is whether people do what they say they're going to do.
Hmm. I want to, first of all, say that we are having a conversation at Bar in New Haven in conjunction with WSHU Public Radio, our friends, and the New England News Collaborative next Tuesday. It's actually about the idea of sanctuary cities. There's more information on our website, WNPR.org. Let's end on a happy note. There's been so much contention and so much friction in today's conversation, Dan. Let's talk about something that happened this week that's really, really exciting. The UConn women's basketball team won their 100th game in a row. Now, this is in some ways old news. They've been winning and winning and winning for more than a decade now. Are we paying too little attention to the fact that this is one of the biggest sports stories maybe in all of American sports history?
I don't know if I would go that far. I think it's a great achievement by Coach Auriemma and the players over the last 4 years, but, you know, the two streaks over the 4 years. But I do think it speaks to the lack of development in the women's game in college, unfortunately. And that's part of the story. It's a great achievement, and I would take nothing away from it, and it's tremendous. It's just it's a question as to who's sitting and watching all these games that are ending in if it's close, 11 points, and if it's not, 30.
And there's less support. There's fewer people watching. Even as this streak goes and goes and goes, this is not the heyday of the game it was some years ago.
Well, that's right, and I thought that as well, and went around two nights ago finding very few people watching in bars. But on the other hand, the ratings from ESPN2 were the best of any college game all year, men or women. So something's happening. People are staying home and watching.
I will say ESPN spent an awful lot of time and effort making sure this was a big game. It was a 9 o'clock game. They put it on their front page of their website. Yes. Are you excited about the UConn women's basketball team, Liz?
I have to tell you, I'm not a big basketball fan. I'm a big football and baseball fan. But, you know, I think the accomplishments are great. I have seen a lot of people sort of going to what you're saying, though, Dan, is like, you know, does this speak to a lack of development among other teams, or does this just speak to how great UConn is? And maybe it's a little bit of both. I have a lot of people sort of hearkening back to the days of Pat Summitt and saying, well, you know, if she were still involved in doing what she did, how do we fare then? So I don't know. I guess that's a better question for Coach Auriemma.
God bless the great Pat Summitt, but we were beating the heck out of her when
she
was
still. Totally, totally agree.
I just put that down. But, you know, I just think that first of all, it's been a 20-year run. It's been 22 years since Rebecca Lobo won, and then Rosati, then when they won that championship.
And I've never seen so much condensed success over such a long period. And part of it does get a little bit stale for people. You can't help. A storyline isn't forever. Secondly, I would just add that, you know, there's a lot of stuff, the conference we play in, the number of corporate donors. There are a lot of things we could try to manage a little bit differently than we do. But bottom line, those ratings don't lie. The press may not be that impressed, but the public is really impressed. And they may not have a Tarazi or a Stewart, but boy, they do flawless execution every night.
Bill Curry, impressive as always. Thank you so much. Liz Karantowicz, so good to have you here in the
Thanks
wheelhouse.
For having me.
Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, thank you so much for joining us here on WNPR.